All right, so here we are, 2 Samuel 8. And David's life is changing. And this is one of those things that happens with the with the advancement of God's calls, is that you hit points of consolidation and summarization where you have to step back and say, man, what is God doing? And what we have here in 2 Samuel, from an editorial standpoint, is a summary passage. Now, what we have is, as we move through the Bible, there are points where it's narrative. And there, as we have seen in 1 and 2 Samuel, sections of narrative where this happens and this happens and this happens. And we hit one of those encapsulating passages here in 2 Samuel 8, where there's a summary of, so in the course of time this occurred. And we get to step back and, from a broader picture, just sort of understand what God has done and ultimately where he's going. And this is a great passage for doing exactly that. And I would like you to even apply it this way as we begin today. What has God done in your life over the last year, over the last few years? If you step back and, in a broader picture, ask the question, all right, man, what is God doing? Where's he leading us? And on a spiritual level, by way of testimony, I'm learning to trust the Lord with more. I'm learning to trust him more. To actually sort of relax in the middle of crisis and go, okay, yeah, he's got this thing. The other is, I'm watching our kids grow up, and as they have changed dramatically through the years. And, of course, now many of you have gone through this before, and we're right there with you, of our oldest daughter is graduating high school and is moving on to the next thing. We think we have an idea of what that thing is, but that means our family's going to change. Ministry's changing. And I've sort of watched God do this thing, and it's left me humble. It's left me sort of at times tearful. And I want you to take this 2016, this first couple of days here, and go, okay, what's God doing? And broader picture, as I back up and I not concentrate on what's going wrong right now, but really look at the pattern of God working in my life over the few years, what do I see? Well, that's sort of what we see here. So verse 1, chapter 8. Now, after this came about that David defeated the Philistines, just so you know, there's an alternative wording. In the course of time, this occurred. In the course of time, David eventually defeated the Philistines and subdued them, and David took control of the chief city from the hand of the Philistines. It's either a reference to Gath, or it's a reference to the broader sense of metropolitan living. God had so worked in David's life that we find the Philistines sort of chased out of cities and living kind of on the run, that they were completely discombobulated. The five kings of the Philistines, who had been a united front during the days of Saul, who had a purpose, who had a plan, now find that plan to be completely upset. And instead, what we see is them now scattered, them discombobulated, then disunified. And that group of people that had seemed like a huge and at times insurmountable enemy now find themselves defeated. And God's doing a different thing. And so that's exactly what we see here. These Philistines, which during the days of the judges and during the days of Saul had seemed so amazing, suddenly come to nothing. And folks, oftentimes I think that's the way you and I are. Remember, I've told you that thing, that wherever we are in life, we tend to think that that's what it's going to be forever. So if things are going poorly, we tend to think, hey, this is my new reality. Life is a disaster and it's going to be this way forever. And that's not true. Life will change. We go through seasons. Things, just by the course of time, they change. And the same conversely, that if we're at a point in life where everything's great, we tend to think, hey, I've got life by the tail. I've finally licked this thing. I know what I'm doing. I have purpose. Well, also moderate your behavior and your thinking, because that will change too. Nobody is ever at a fixed point in life. Life is constantly changing. It's going to go up and down. And so you may face an enemy like the Philistines, and you go, man, this is my life. This is reality. We're never going to beat this thing. And actually, right now, I'm sort of in the middle of that with a project where I am prone to think, or my brain is wanting to think, I am never going to be out of this season. I'm never going to be done with this thing. This is just a monster. But truthfully, if I don't give up, if I push through, if I keep at it, yeah, it'll change, it'll turn around, or I'll fail and start over. And it'll be all right. And so that's where David is with the Philistines. And then that's his enemy in the west. Then we immediately turn over to the east. He defeated Moab and measured them with a line, making them lie down on the ground. And he measured two lines and put to death and one full line to keep alive. So two-thirds of the Moabites he wipes out. Many people say, man, that seems pretty harsh. David wipes out two-thirds of the population of Moab. Notice also that these are actually related to him. The Moabites kept his parents safe during his sojourning in the wilderness as he ran from Saul. And now David has come around and he's killing Moabites. So two-thirds of them. Well, we understand. Life changes. The Moabites at some point become his enemies. There is either a fear of him taking too much control or whatever, but a war occurs between the Moabites and the Israelites, and so David knocks down their population to keep them under control. And so it says the Moabites became servants to David, bringing tribute. And then David defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, and went and restored his rule at the river. And David captured him from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung the chariot horses, but reserved enough of them for 100 chariots. When the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 Arameans. And then David put garrisons among the Arameans of Damascus, and the Arameans became servants to David, bringing tribute. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. Now, the Arameans are a kingdom in the north. And it should be noted here that at the time, from a couple of hundred years before this, the Arameans were on the rise. Arameans, we should note, are not a kingdom in the way that you typically view kingdoms in the ancient Near East, with a fixed boundary, a set of land, and this formal court structure. The Arameans were actually a much more loosely affiliated group of tribesmen, but they were numerous. They were so numerous, in fact, that they affected the language group of the ancient Near East. The whole reason that Jesus and the disciples spoke Aramaic more than they spoke Hebrew was because of the Arameans. They were so numerous. There were so many of them, and they were so dispersed that they affected the language group of the ancient Near East. So when Darius came in, he actually adopted Aramaic as the language of trade for that region. And it wasn't until Alexander the Great that it was supplanted by Greek. But the whole reason the New Testament was really the language spoken by the disciples and Jesus was Aramaic was because of the Arameans and because of their wide dispersal and influence. But notice that David captures these guys and destroys these guys, 22,000 of them. But also notice a little hint in Scripture, a little hint. There are 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers. David hamstrings or cuts the Achilles of the horses so that they are hobbled, so that they can no longer be used for warfare. He makes at least 1,700 of them ineffective for war, but then keeps 100 or enough for 100 chariots. So it's either two horse chariots or one horse chariot. At the time, they were using Egyptian chariots, probably one horse per chariot. But notice there that there's a hint towards God's way, because God had told Israel not to have or collect a bunch of horses. It was not the role of God's army to rely on modern warfare or to rely on the newest, greatest tools of warfare. And the chariot was considered one of those amazing tools of warfare. And God said, look, I don't want you to be those people, because first of all, horses eat and consume a lot of resource, and they just wind up chewing up all your gain. The second is, I don't want you to be trusting in your chariots the way the Egyptians do, or the way the Arameans do, or the way the Hittites did. And folks, there's a lesson there. God says this lesson all over the Old Testament. What are you trusting in? And there are things in life that you will look at for your trust. There are things that you will absolutely adopt the world's mindset and say, I've got it because I've got this. And in the same way, armies in the ancient Near East felt invincible when they had chariots, so also you and I do this with any number of things in life. It's the same way as the guy in the New Testament who collected and filled his barns with goods. And as he filled them with goods, more than he could ever use, he sat back and he said, oh, I have got life taken care of. And my trust now, my future, is absolutely secured. Are there things like that for you? Are there things like that for you? Where you're like, hey, I've got my health. I am so ridiculously healthy. And this is absolutely true in my life. It's really led me to humility because I've been crazy healthy my whole life. And there's some of you are that way. You've just been healthy your whole life. And I know I'm not going to stay this way. But I would be prone. You know, it's kind of like once in a while Adam and I will get in these discussions. And he's like, hey, one of these days you'll have your moment. And I always answer Adam, I say, oh, I'm going to be fine. Just to be a snot. That's really what I do there. But he's right. I will have my day. But there is a thing. I am so used to being healthy that I kind of think, hey, I'm always going to be this way. And I know that's not true. But you're prone. I could trust in that health. And some of you, you may look at your 401 and you go, hey, I've got my 401k. Whatever happens, my future's secure here. Or I finally got fully vested in my retirement. My future is secure here. Or I finally got all of my kids out of the house. My future is secure here. And you have this idea, you attach that. And well, that's really what David's dealing with. And you got to understand the tremendous temptation that David captures a huge armed force. Now, the soldiers, you never be sure of their loyalty. But, man, these horses, these things are valuable. These things, we could have chariots and really become invincible. We could become a much stronger army. But God had said, don't multiply and collect horses for yourself. That's what the world trusts in. That's their method. Keep only a few. And so David, at this point in his career, you see him practically laying out and trusting God in real life terms. These horses that are valuable, which he could sell, he actually makes ineffective so they can never be used against him, but also he can't use them. And that's an interesting mindset. We see David adopting practically God's priorities. And then God puts garrisons in the north in Damascus. The Arameans become servants, and they begin to bring tribute. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. You realize here, this is God's blessing. And then David took the shields of gold, which were carried by the servant of Hadadezer, and brought them to Jerusalem from Betah, from Berothai, cities of Hadadezer. King David took very large amounts of bronze. Now when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer, Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to greet him, to bless him, because he fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had been at war with Toi. And Joram brought with him articles of silver, of gold, and of bronze. King David also dedicated these to the Lord with the silver and the gold that had been dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued, from Aram and Moab, the sons of Ammon, the Philistines, Amalek, and from the spoil of Hadadezer, son of Reb, king of Zobah. You realize what's going on here, folks, is that we see the recorder, the court record of that is really made up of 2 Samuel, stepping back and taking a broad picture of what God is doing. God is destroying David's enemies, and he's giving him success wherever he goes. And not only that, but you see David responding to God's working with a right heart. And this is the biggest battle for you in your Christian life. That when you come to periods of ease or periods where life makes sense, of maintaining a God focus and God's priorities. This is the biggest challenge you face continually in your Christian life. When you come to a point where you're fruitful in ministry, where you're fruitful in business, where you're fruitful financially, you're fruitful health, you're fruitful in your family, all of these areas of fruitfulness, the question is, can you go through a period of blessing and maintain God's mindset when you do? This is an area of struggle for me. I know what to do in crisis. I know that prayer works, and I know that God has a plan. And when crisis comes, I go, okay, God's doing a thing. But man, when I come into periods of blessing where everything makes sense, it is a struggle for me to walk with God with the same closeness that I do with when there's a middle of crisis. And maybe you're the same way. I struggle with that. How do I maintain a quiet time? How do I maintain prayer life? How do I maintain God's priorities and stay away from sin when everything around me goes great? And what we see in David is David really maintaining a God focus. At this point in his career, he's maintaining a God focus. He obeys God in the issue of horses. We also see here an understanding God is helping him wherever he goes, and he keeps crediting God for what he's doing. And we remember last week's passage where David comes up against a blessing from God, where God says, David, I'm going to work with you in your line perpetually, where God gives him, in essence, a license there about his future. And David says, oh, who am I? Who am I that you would do a work for me like that? And folks, that's a good question for you. You want to walk with the Lord continually when things are going great? Learn humility. Learn humility. And say, man, who am I that God would save my soul? Who am I that He would bleed and die on a cross for me? That is one of those key elements to keeping you in a right relationship with God when things are going well, as well as in crisis. And so what we see is, as a result of David succeeding, God is also giving David earned respect. Toi, a king who he really has no connection with at all, but a guy who was fighting an enemy of David, the friend of my enemy, or rather, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That idea that's sort of brought forth here. Toi is a guy who has no connection with David, but he finds himself under David's hegemony and acquiesces to that. We see Toi giving David respect as he recognizes what God is doing. And what we see here, folks, is one of those things that happens rarely. David takes on the persona of being undefeatable. At times in your life, you're going to have blessing like that. I believe this is absolutely true. There are going to be points in your life where everything works, and you begin to think, and the perception of other people is that you are undefeatable. And I want you to understand there's a good thing in that. There's a good thing in that. That when God blesses us, blessing is blessing. Be thankful. But also understand that as people see it, they respond to it. And they're going to respond for a couple of different reasons. One is that people will recognize that God's doing a work in your life, and they will absolutely rejoice with you. People love to see blessing in the life of another person. It's a wonderful thing. In the same way, we can celebrate with Brooke's job and with the Osborne's new baby. And we see, man, God's doing a thing there. This is wonderful. Let's rejoice. But there's another thing that happens, is that people who want to be a part or take advantage of what God's doing in your life will also come alongside. And there's a danger in that. That sometimes people are just there out of envy. Sometimes they are there because they want what you want and want what you have. And what we see is that Toi may be one of those guys, a pagan king who comes up under David's hegemony. And so he offers to him a tribute, a blessing. And I want you to notice what David does with it. David takes all of the conquered gold, all of the conquered silver, all of the donated goods, God's blessings, and instead of enriching himself, He gives these to the Lord's work. Now, people have noticed that. And I just want to reread that verse, verse 11. King David also dedicated these to the Lord, referencing what Toya had just brought him. Dedicated these to the Lord with the silver and the gold that he had dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued, from Aram and Moab, from the sons of Ammon, the Philistines, and Amalek, and the spoil of Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. So David made a name for himself, and so he returned from killing 18,000 Arameans in the Valley of Salt. What we have to understand here, and I don't know exactly how to apply this to you, but there's a principle here. There's a principle here that I think is an amazingly good thing, is that as David is enriched in all of these enemies, as he conquers them and as they fall under his hegemony and they give tribute, David doesn't keep any of that stuff. He passes it along to the Lord's work. And there's a certain political nature in that, but I think there's also a principle. David doesn't want to have other people make him rich, especially the enemies. He doesn't want to have those guys say, well, David wouldn't be so great, wouldn't be so rich, wouldn't be so whatever if he had not conquered such and such, and such and such really made him wealthy. David rather looks on those things and he says, look, I'm going to pass these along to the Lord's house, and we're going to use these things for a different purpose, and the purpose will actually pop up later. But there's something in this, folks, and I don't know exactly how to apply this other than to say this, that occasionally God gives us things in life, either somebody complimenting or somebody praising or somebody even giving you a gift and those kinds of things. There are worthwhile principles there. There are worthwhile procedures there to say, hey, should I keep this thing or should I pass it along? As God works in my life and I bless another person and they say, hey, really appreciate this ministry you've had in my life, instead of just saying thank you, maybe just say, hey, you know, that's really God's working in my life. That's something that God's doing. And maybe that's a good method to keep us humble. But there does seem to be this issue and this principle in Scripture that sometimes the things that God gives us through another person should just be passed along to bless somebody else or to return to him as a blessing. And you see that with David. David doesn't want his hands on any of this stuff coming from these other nations. He passes along to the temple for that work. Verse 13. So David made a name for himself when he returned from killing 18,000 Arameans in the Valley of Salt. He put garrisons in Edom. In all of Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants to David. And the Lord helped David wherever he went. Notice that twice now. The Lord helped David wherever he went. This is a season in a broad sense over these years. David becomes undefeatable because God's doing a thing. And you're going to have seasons in your life that way where you win. Where you win over and over and over again. Don't let it go to your head. Understand, this is God working in my life, either advancing me in my career or advancing me in my home or advancing me in something else. God's doing a thing. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and righteousness for all his people. So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. And Sariah was secretary. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and Peliathites. And David's sons were chief ministers. And what we see here is, in a broad perspective, in this summary passage, something that David's in charge of, but also something that God's in charge of. That God is causing David to win. And he's causing David to win so that his name might be great. But also understand that as David is working in God's people and with God's people, it's his job to follow righteousness. Folks, this is one of the great mysteries of human beings, but it's an absolute truth. We gravitate towards evil when we're winning. Tim and I were watching, some of you may have seen this, we were watching this documentary on prohibition. And I had always been fascinated, and it's something I've got to take up further study in. I had always been fascinated in how prohibition became synonymous in the mindset of Americans with the religious community. That somehow temperance was equated with being a Christian. And I wondered where that transition occurred. And I've never been a prohibition, pro-prohibition guy. The idea of alcohol being illegal in the United States always struck me as a weird chapter in American history. But it was actually a reaction to something. And Kim and I were talking about it. We watched that and we were fascinated by it. Is that in the mid-1800s, the American population began to drink more. And really what you kind of see in that is as America was coming into its own, and it was changing, and it was becoming more prosperous, that human beings in America were drinking a lot. And I can't remember exactly the figure, but it was something like people over the age of 16, the average person over the age of 16, was drinking 43 gallons of alcoholic beverage a year. That seems like a lot. If it doesn't seem like a lot, you should give me a call. We have an issue. And so there was concern because the net effect in the family was destructive. Is that you had a nation of drunkards, in essence, developing. I mean, you're talking about 16 and up. 16-year-olds drinking whiskey as a normal part of their routine day. And you go, man, what was happening? And you realize that the temperance movement, the prohibition movement after it, was a reaction to this thing that was happening in the country. It was the wrong reaction, but you saw it. And what absolutely seems to be the case is that as the country began to prosper, they began to do evil with prosperity. Guys, this is us. This is us. That when we go into seasons of prosperity, we tend to do evil with prosperity. It's something we just gravitate to. And if you just begin with that presupposition, if you begin with that spot, man, I think you could change your life. That actually, areas where God is blessing me can become potential areas of downfall for me. And at this point in David's life, what we see is David taking God's prospering and God's prosperity, and he's turning it back to God. He's doing right things with it. He gets more money in and he gives more out. He wins more, but he keeps humble in the midst of winning. We see him understanding God's the one who's doing a work. This isn't me. And so what we see in David's life in the broad perspective is continually a reliance on the Lord while he's winning. This is an area we've got to grow. Because folks, understand, if you're not in a season of blessing right now, you're going to be. The question is, what are you going to do with it when it gets here? Well, our nature is to do evil with prosperity. The call of God is to do exactly the opposite. Recognize it for what it is, as the hand of God, and then do righteously with it. David, in the middle of his prosperity, in verse 15, it says that David reigned over all Israel, administrating justice and righteousness for all of Israel. David doesn't take the season of prosperity and turn it into a season of licentiousness. He doesn't turn it into an environment where sin can prosper. Instead, he recognizes, this part is my control. I can administrate justice. I can be God's guy in the role in which God's put me. That's where you need to be. As God hands you blessing in your life, figure out what you're supposed to do with it. Becoming a person of righteousness and justice with it. Do rightly with your family. If your family's doing well, don't take it for granted. If your health is doing well, don't take it for granted. If you're doing well in your career, don't take it for granted. Learn that there are things that you're supposed to do with that. especially if you want to see that continue. I want this year for you to be back up off this year at the end of this year and go, wow, look what God has done. I want you to be able to get to December and go, hey, these are areas where we put these things in front of God and we wanted to do rightly with them and look at what God has done. I think it's a worthy goal. I think it's a worthwhile mindset to take into 2016. And I challenge you to do it. Let's go to prayer. Father God, I do thank you for this day. Thank you for the example of our brother David, even in the middle of a sort of a summary passage that steps back and takes a broader view. Father, help us to do that. Help us to step back off our lives and identify areas where we need to grow and areas where you're working. Help us to do rightly with those things, because it's your grace that bought us. It's the cross that purchased us. And everything else is a blessing. Help us to figure out what to do with the blessings, even as we rest in the work of the cross. And it's in your name we pray. Amen.